Welcome back to Aberdeen Proving Grounds Hidden History. I am your host, Sean Keefe, along with my co-hosts, Susan, Sister Goldenhair Thompson. Really, you're going to go with that one, Sister Goldenhair?
I don't know.
Though you're more of a redhead than a blonde. But you know, if that's what makes you happy, that's okay with me.
You can call me the Stone Pony.
Stone Pony? Yeah. We should see, like, in the comments below if somebody can actually get that reference to the Stone Pony. I don't know. I would be surprised, but...
You're underestimating the brilliance of our listening audience, Sean.
Maybe I am. Prove me wrong. I love it. Anyway, I'm pretty excited about today's episode because I have been on the proving ground for about 20 plus years, and I've always heard, or whispers... of a place called Fort Hoyle that existed on the proving ground. Not much is said, not much exists. Now, down in Edgewood is the gym, which is called the Hoyle Gymnasium, which is the only reference to Fort Hoyle that I could find.
There is a Fort Hoyle road that is not on the installation. It's just off the installation, but...
Well, that's not doing us much good, is it?
But so those names, Fort Hoyle Road... and the Hoyle Gymnasium are what I knew, too, about what was Fort Hoyle.
Mm-hmm.
And I have also been, and I spent 12 years at Edgewood
Arsenal.
And I've been at APG over 20 years. And it is one of those mysteries
yes.
of Edgewood Arsenal.
Now, let me ask you this. This Fort Hoyle Road that you're referring to, is it outside the Magnolia Gate?
Yes, it is in that area.
Because the Magnolia Gate exists because of Fort Hoyle they wanted to separate themselves from Edgewood Arsenal.
That's right, Sean.
So I do know something.
You know so much more than you think, Sean.
Look at me bringing something to the table for once. I like it. I love it.
Well, let me set up a little background for those who aren't as brilliant as Sean, which is most of us.
Do what you do.
Our last episode, we talked about the development of Edgewood Arsenal and the Chemical Warfare Service and how that all developed to support World War I. So after World War I, there was an effort, which is typical for the Army, for the United States. After a war, we demobilize. We shrink things. We stop.
Do we really?
Well,
you would never know.
Historically, that was the way the Army worked. It ebbed and it flowed based mm-hmm. on what was happening in the world. So after the end of World War I, there wasn't a belief that we needed to be as big as we were at the time. So the Army shrunk itself, which led to a lot of underuse of the facilities at Edgewood Arsenal. There just wasn't the call for the number of soldiers, for the number of buildings that existed.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1921, the War Department decided that there needed to be a new field artillery post in the Third Corps area of the United States, which is sort of the northeast area. There was a field artillery training area, but it was up at Toby Hanna.
Interesting. Okay.
But it was being used for training by the National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
So they really felt they needed to have a new field artillery post. So the War Department directive selected the Gunpowder Neck as the site for this new field artillery post. The Chemical Warfare Service people who were currently stationed at mm-hmm. Edgewood.
Edgewood Arsenal.
Which was the entirety of Edgewood Arsenal. We're not necessarily happy about this because in General Orders Number 40 from October 1922, the War Department created Fort Hoyle. And how they did that, they basically took half of Edgewood Arsenal away from the Chemical Warfare Service and created this new post.
Mm-hmm.
So it's totally within the boundaries of what was Edgewood Arsenal,
mm-hmm.
but it's a separate post with a separate commander, and it's under a totally different service. It's under the field artillery.
Now, did Fort Hoyle take over the ranges? that existed for the arsenal and for the Ordnance Center.
They didn't take them over, but they were shared.
Shared.
So basically, Fort Hoyle, if you think of the area of Edgewood Arsenal that's above the ranges now, mm-hmm. that's not behind the fence, as we okay. would say, about half of that was given to become what was called Fort Hoyle. Starting in the northwest corner of the arsenal, right at the edge by the railroad
Let
line.
Me just tell our audience that Susan's using a lot of hand gestures to kind of like
I'm trying give, to circulate there the you, idea.
Yeah, I understand right. it.
And then it sort of follows along the line of Canal Creek, and then it goes underneath where the...
I love how your whole body's getting into it now, too. You're going underneath, and you're swinging your hands up, and okay.
Yep. So underneath where the industrial areas were that we talked about in our last episode, mm-hmm. all the way over to the east side, Kings Creek, and then south. If you have any experience with Edgewood Arsenal, the area around where the chapel is, where the movie theater is, where the World War I barracks were.
Oh, I got something to add, too.
Okay.
Okay, because, you know, things just pop into my brain. So the theater, which is now the conference center down in Edgewood,
right.
that was built by Fort Hoyle.
Yes.
Along with the chapel, correct?
Yes. I don't believe that chapel dates from the time that Fort Hoyle was there. I think that was a replacement from the 60s.
Oh, the existing.
Right.
Yeah, but they built the original right. chapel down there.
Right. And they really needed to, because when they got here, they marched down. They had been assigned to Fort Dix mm-hmm. in New Jersey. So they were given their orders in October of 1922. They marched down from New Jersey to the new Fort Hoyle. And what they found was not a whole lot. They had the barracks, the World mm-hmm. War I barracks, which were given over to them.
Oh, yes. Okay.
But other than that, there wasn't much. There was a lot of mud. There were some old farmhouses. There were some warehouses. And they were kind of left hanging. And you have to remember, in the 1920s, there wasn't a lot of money being mm-hmm. given to Army installations for construction.
Well, that's, yeah, because it's not wartime.
Right, right. The commander of Fort Hoyle really wanted to create, like, his own installation, his own facilities, a self-sufficient post. But that never really happened. They were always forced to share facilities with Edgewood Arsenal, mm-hmm. which was still in existence. It was much smaller, but it was still the part to the northeast.
Let me ask you this. So you have APG North, which is Aberdeen Proving Ground.
Right.
You have what is today APG South, which is Edgewood Arsenal at the time.
Right.
Did they act as two separate installations, or were they under the command of the highest ranking officer?
After 1922, they were two separate installations.
They were?
Yes.
Okay.
They both had their own commanders. They shared some facilities.
Do you know if they were general officers? Was it that high ranking? Or
I think it was colonels for the most part. To clarify a little bit, the group that came down to Fort Hoyle was the 6th Field Artillery Unit. Mm-hmm. And they were a pretty famous unit of the field artillery. They are actually credited with firing the first American shots in World War I in France.
Really?
Yes. Brigadier General Eli Hoyle was in charge of the regiment at the time in France.
Okay.
And he had just died in 1921. And okay. he was recognized widely as really modernizing this field artillery. They were a horse-mounted unit. They had a bunch of 75-millimeter guns, mm-hmm. and they were pulled by teams of horses. So it would require a team of 6 horses per gun.
Mm-hmm.
What General Hoyle was credited with was his unit was mounted, so they said they could get to the fight as fast as the cavalry could. So they were called like this whirlwind
wow.
regiment. So he was really given credit for making this a very efficient, modern field artillery, even though they were still a horse-mounted unit.
Okay.
So the equipment that was mostly used by this field artillery unit were these 75-millimeter guns, which, as I said, were pulled by a team of 6 horses.
Mm-hmm.
So when this group came to Fort Hoyle. It was described as having 1,000 horses and 1,000 men.
And with horses, you need stables.
Right. They really had to begin a construction program. And they actually did in 1923, a group of about 14 officers' houses were constructed, which are the ones that we saw when we visited the Presbury House, and then ones further down closer to the river as well. So those are still in existence. They're still used as officers' housing. Those were all built for Fort Hoyle as officers' housing. They followed the quartermaster corps plans, which were the standardized plans for Army housing at the time. I think we talked about it in the first season. The Army would base their housing or any construction based on the area. Here at Fort Hoyle, it was Dutch Colonial Revival style and Colonial Revival style. So they have hipped roofs. So there's the 10 houses that are close to the Presbury House, and those were field grade officers, so they were slightly smaller. They were around 2,000 square feet or so. Also colonel level housing, and those were over like upper 2,000 square feet. Okay. And then there is one other building in those houses that are close to the river, which was actually the honeymoon cottage built by Thomas Cadwallader in 1910.
All right.
So remember from last time, we talked about how General George Cadwallader left all his property to his nephew, John. Mm-hmm. This was John's son, Thomas. He built a honeymoon cottage in 1910, and that was used as officers' housing, and it continues to be there today. So that is a slightly different style because it wasn't built by the Army. That's another property that
Is this a frame house?
It's a frame house. It's a Colonial Revival house. That is another building that predates the Army, but it just fits in with the rest of the officers' housing down there. So
250 years. That's how long the U.S. Army has stood watch over this great nation, defending our freedom through every storm. In the bloodiest battles of the 20th century, American soldiers answered the call, fighting wherever liberty was at risk. In 1941, when the world plunged into war yet again, the Army was ready. From the deserts of North Africa to the hedgerows of France, from the islands of the Pacific to the streets of Berlin, U.S. soldiers carried the weight of the free world. On June 6, 1944, they stormed the beaches of Normandy, charging through the surf and gunfire, and climbing cliffs against overwhelming odds. Victory was never certain, but they fought fiercely and triumphed. Their fight wasn't just for America. It was for millions silenced by tyranny.
So in addition to the officers' housing, as you said, they had to build stables. Mm-hmm. There was a riding ring. There was an officers' club, which had been in existence prior to the artillery arriving. That was there early on, and which has since been demolished, but it was also in the area of the officers' housing and all that. So the horses were a major, major part of what the troops were working with every day. So the horses weren't only used for work. They had a polo club.
They did.
They had a polo club. They had riding events. They had shows where people would come just to watch them do horsey tricks.
Horses.
The area of Fort Hoyle was actually used for the Army to do its training in the early 1930s, prior to the 1932 Olympics, because the Army would send a horse riding team to the Olympics.
Which is interesting, because what exists today is the Hoyle Gymnasium, which was the riding hall for Fort Hoyle.
Right. They built that sort of towards the end of their tenure, 1938 or so. There was, as I said, an outdoor riding ring. This was an indoor facility where they...
And a gorgeous building.
Gorgeous
nice
building,
stone building.
That
still exists.
Right. Constructed of port deposit granite. So, you know, using those local materials as they like to do, just like the officers' club up here at APG. It's the same materials kind of thing. So they weren't only building these, you know, facilities where they interacted every day, but they were also working heavily on the ranges. And you had asked about the ranges. So the ranges were shared among the three entities. They were shared among Fort Hoyle, Edgewood Arsenal and then the Ordnance Center.
Yeah.
Because they would fire over the water and fire into the ranges, the lower areas. So
imagine the internal battles that were going on in those offices.
Right.
I could just see it now.
We've read articles from the Field Artillery Journal in 1933, and they put a very nice spin on it. Oh, we work so well together. But
it was a struggle.
So the ranges that the field artillery used were closest to Fort Hoyle, so the area of Maxwell Point.
Mm-hmm.
So the soldiers were using the Maxwell Point area quite a bit. And one thing I read that was interesting, there used to be these stone pillars with metal gates that was defined the entrance to Maxwell Point, the big mansion that General Cadwallader had built.
Mm-hmm.
I read that those gates were moved and used in the parking lot area of the theater, mm-hmm. which is now the conference center. Those don't exist anymore. Who knows whatever happened to those gates? But that was an area. They used it not only for ranges, but they also were using it for recreation. Although it was kind of a dangerous area, I guess the water was pretty rough, and any number of soldiers drowned right off of Maxwell Point because the water was dangerous with a rip current kind of thing, and they couldn't.
When you say drown, was this for leisure?
Yes, they were swimming.
Okay. I know that, like you said, with all the amenities that were down in Edgewood, one of them was swimming.
Right. They had to entertain the troops, and there wasn't anything there originally. And as we said, they built a movie theater. There was a pool built. They did riding. There were still hunting clubs. The area in the northwest corner of Fort Hoyle was where the San Domingo Club was, and they still did skeet shooting and things like that for the officers. They were hunting ducks.
Mm-hmm.
That continued the whole time. But not only were they, the troops here, doing their training exercises, and there were some benefits to them being so closely associated with Edgewood Arsenal and the Chemical Warfare Service. There was one article I found where they were doing practice maneuvers, transporting the guns and the horses across the Gunpowder River, but they were doing it behind a smoke shield, which they had got from the Chemical Warfare Service. So they could practice concurrence with each other, so they could each use the facilities of the other to support their missions.
Now, is there a reason why they decided to move the artillery unit here? I mean, not keep them where they were. I mean, what was attractive about
I think they just had this big installation that they had just purchased,
okay,
put money into, and then, as I said, after the end of World War I, they weren't really sure what the need for chemical warfare was going to be. They left the Chemical Warfare Service there, but it was much smaller than what it had been. So they were just utilizing, I think, the land area that they had and created this installation within an installation, which was called Fort Hoyle. But it's kind of interesting because it seems like the soldiers from Fort Hoyle were very quickly integrated into local events and things. The 6th Field Artillery came down in October of 1922. The end of November, they were doing a big field games that were open to the public. They were doing both mounted and dismounted games,
mm-hmm.
In December of that year.
Did they do any real work? Because it seems like they were just playing the time.
Yes, they did do real work. But in December of that...
Unless that's considered real work,
In December of that year, 1922, there was a football game between the Army and the Marines in Baltimore.
Okay.
So this was like, I guess, before the Army or during the Army-Navy game, something a little different, but it was
there.
Army and Marines. And it's happening in December of 1922. But of course, the mascot for the Army is always a mule. And mm-hmm. there's newspaper articles that talks about how they picked the meanest, crankiest mule from Fort Hoyle to represent the Army so that it could kick the bulldog of the Marines out of business. So,
wow.
So in addition to all those fun activities, they were doing actual training. Their training consisted of marches up to 135 miles that lasted for days. They did a lot of construction in the range area because it was kind of a really flat, marshy area. So they built these observation towers and firing towers so that they could train their artillery better and observe. So this was all being done by the soldiers. They were doing this construction. They were clearing areas. Although at one point they did stop relying on soldier work and relied on sheep to help keep.
Now we're in the sheep.
To help keep the grass trimmed.
Well, I thought they used goats for that.
No, no? They had a flock of sheep.
Okay.
That they would use.
So. I gotta look into that. I got an acre and a half
That's
to take
right.
care of.
Get a goat or a sheep and you'll be good. But they were also doing other events at the time. One article I saw had soldiers from the field artillery going down to Ocean City, taking hold of, this was during Prohibition, seizing illegal liquor imports that were coming in. And then in 1926, a group of over 1,000 soldiers from the Third Corps area, mostly from Maryland, including those from Fort Hoyle and Edgewood Arsenal, marched up to Philadelphia for the America's sesquicentennial, just like we're doing now for the Army's 250. There was a celebration for America's 150 up in Philadelphia, and 6th Field Artillery went up there and represented the Army in that event.
The 6th Field Artillery, were they ever used in battle?
They were redeployed and used in World War II. I believe they continue to exist today in different locations. So.
Okay.
But one other interesting note of history is that Fort Hoyle was the site of what is called the Citizens Military Training Camps.
Please do tell what that is.
So this was a movement that grew out of, I don't know if you've ever heard this, it was called the Plattsburgh Movement or the Preparedness Movement.
Is that something to do with the Great Depression?
No, this is actually...
Then let me rephrase that.
Okay.
No, Susan, I don't. I have no idea.
All right. So back in 1913, General Leonard Wood, you've probably heard of Fort Leonard Wood.
Yes, I have.
Okay. So Leonard Wood was the chief of staff of the Army. And a military professor from Cornell University dropped in on him in D.C. and had an idea because he had heard that the Navy was taking college students out on a 2-month summer trip on their boats to give them a little training experience. And Leonard Wood thought this was a fabulous idea and that the Army should do something similar. So as early as 1913, there were two camps that were set up. One was in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and the other was out in California around the Presidio of Monterey. And basically, these were just a month-long training camp to get the citizens of America trained and ready for in case war would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some very big proponents of this at the time. So not only was Leonard Wood behind this, but someone you may have heard of, Theodore Roosevelt.
I have no idea who that is.
So he was a huge proponent of the idea that America needed to train its citizens. And Leonard Wood had grand plans that there would be mandatory military training for young men.
Now, was Roosevelt president?
No, this was after he was president.
After he was president.
So this continued for the next couple of years. Then around 1915, they started what was called the Businessman's Camp in Plattsburgh, New York. So this is where the Plattsburgh movement came from. And basically, it was wealthy men who had jobs, volunteered to spend a month, and then later it was called the Tired Businessman's Camp. And this was what it was called in the newspapers, but really promoting the idea of this preparedness movement. There was an idea in 1916 to start this authorized camps more broadly. But of course, right at that time, the United States entered World War I in April of 1917. So that sort of killed the idea of these camps because they were focused on recruiting and training actual officers at the time. But after the war, the National Defense Act of 1920 authorized the military to conduct these camps to train young men. And the whole idea behind it was that it was different from the National Guard or the organized reserves in that the program allowed male citizens to obtain basic military training without obligation. The idea was it was open to initially in the first year, young men between the ages of 17 and 36. And it was a month-long training.
36. That's kind of old.
Yeah. It was a month-long training. They were given clothes, food, board, and a 5 cent per mile travel reimbursement.
Hmm.
So in 1921 is the first year that this happened. And there were over 40,000 people who applied for what ended up being about 11,000 slots.
Wow.
So these were held around the country. The original idea behind it was to have it be a three-part course. It was eventually expanded into a four-year course. Mm-hmm. And it was originally called the Red, White, and Blue course. So the idea was that if you had no training at all, nothing, you could go for 1 month each summer. And at the end of that time, you could potentially get a commission from this.
Okay.
They adjusted it later. So the following year, they contracted the age allowance to 17 to 25.
That sounds more like it to me. Yeah.
And the following year, they established more camps and they doubled the number. So there were like over 22,000 men who were trained the following year.
Mm-hmm.
So the first references that I could find to the citizens' military training camps being held at Fort Hoyle was in 1927. And that was actually the peak year for the CMTC. They had 53 camps that year and over 40,000 men were trained.
Wow.
Leonard Wood had these grand schemes that they would train 100,000 men a year.
Mm-hmm.
It just never happened. There were other local camps, including Fort Meade. And these continued so the first camp was in 1921, and then the camps continued through 1940, at which point, again,
yes,
we were beginning to enter a war.
Yeah.
But it was really an opportunity, and there's a really interesting book called Forgotten Summer, and it's written by a man who basically conducted a lot of oral history interviews with people who had participated in these camps.
Mm-hmm.
And they just relate their experiences. And they, you know, they were all different. So at Fort Hoyle, obviously, they were training under the field artillery. So they were learning how to do basic drill, how to salute, how to march, how to fire weapons, all that kind of stuff. Evidently, it was about 5 hours a day of training. Along with there were, you know, sports and teams. And at the end of it, there was always a big ceremony and people were given awards for, you know, best participant, all that. But this was really popular. As I said, there were some really big proponents of it. Multiple people that you've probably heard of were involved with it. Two future presidents participated in the camps, not specifically at Fort Hoyle, but, mm-hmm, you know, in the CTMC. Harry Truman as a reserve officer.
I can see that.
Because they actually, later in the camps, they sent reserve officers to do their training along with the younger men.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of their training. And then Ronald Reagan.
Mm.
And he actually said it was one of the best things that he had ever done because he ended up being commissioned out of it. When this was first being set up by Leonard Wood, one of the people directed to help establish them in 1913 was a Captain Douglas MacArthur.
Oh.
And he All would, right. So in, in the 30s, when MacArthur was the chief of staff of the Army, he continued to be a big proponent for these camps. And mm-hmm, he was, you know, in charge of the Third Corps area. So General Pershing was a fan. He would go to the graduation ceremonies for a bunch of these, and he had retired at this mm-hmm time.
And you have to think, as you're coming into the 1930s, there's also the Great Depression going on.
Right.
So this was an opportunity for men to come. You get three meals a day. You get a bed to sleep in.
Exactly. And that was a big draw for a lot of people, was the reimbursement. There was a lot of, based on the oral histories, there was a lot of fudging of things. Like people, you know, the minimum age was supposed to be 16.
There were 16.
There were, you know, and then they bumped it up to 17. But there are people who said they were 14 when they were in. Like they would just, you know, blah.
Yeah.
But like, or they, you know, you got paid by the mile. So mm-hmm, you got reimbursed at the end of it. But people would be hopping freight trains and getting the money. So, you know, they could get $20 out of it, which was a huge amount of money at the time. And
yeah.
And then another aspect,
especially when you think of the alternative, which
right,
is nothing.
Right. Another sort of camp that that's associated with Fort Hoyle was the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was a big program in during the Great Depression, established by Franklin Roosevelt, of course. And this was to provide jobs for unemployed men. And the camps would meet at Fort Hoyle. So the men were brought into Fort Hoyle and sort of given conditioning for about 2 weeks before they were sent off. A lot of them went to the Rockies, went out to the national parks. These are the groups that were building roads and national parks and walls and camps and all this. So they were really, and a lot of that was just giving them food. There was a physical required for both the CMTC camps and the Civilian Conservation Corps. And usually when people were rejected, it was because they were severely malnourished and they just didn't.
That's
horrible. But usually they could condition people within a couple of weeks and then send them on their way to their next assignments.
So you're saying the camps existed side by side?
Right. So basically, Fort Hoyle was a processing center for the CCC beginning in 1933. So basically, they were bringing in men from Philadelphia and other areas and sort of gathering them together. Because basically, at the time, there was some discomfort with the idea that the Army would be running this because, you know, fascism was going on. There was concern that you're indoctrinating people. So they were really trying to keep the CCC separate from the Army. But at the time, they were like, no one else could do this but the Army to get these men processed, get them, you know, prepared, get them ready to send out within a short time frame. Fort Hoyle and the CMTC both kind of ended their runs at the same time. And this was all the buildup to World War II. Mm-hmm. So in 1940, the war was on the horizon. I mean, Europe was already involved.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
The War Department decided to discontinue Fort Hoyle, and it was given back to the Chemical Warfare Service. So basically, 1940, Fort Hoyle doesn't exist anymore. Mm. So it had a very brief time frame. So it was only in existence from 1922 until 1940, and then doesn't exist anymore.
Poof.
But if you've been to that area, a lot of what's there was used as Fort Hoyle.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't really obvious. There is a memorial to the 6th Field Artillery outside of the Hoyle Gymnasium. So there's a little bit there left. But it is amazing how it sort of vanished into the ether.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, been here 20 years. Again, it's just whispers.
Right.
You know, like, okay, yeah, this place did exist here, but, you know, really, what was it?
Yeah. So at the same time...
And thank God they have us to tell everyone what it was.
Right. So the CMTC also ended in 1940. That was the last year of the camp because after
Then you're really recruiting. Yeah, sure.
But it wasn't a super successful recruiting effort. I mean, but they weren't keeping great records either. Like, I think what I read was they couldn't really say more than like 5,000 officers came in through that. But then they weren't counting the people who maybe did a summer or two and then went on and went to military academy or went into ROTC or, you know, given that little bit of experience and familiarity with military practices. I mean, there were books. I mean, I found one online. That's the Red Course. It was supposed to be a textbook that you would read ahead of time. It talks about how to salute people and what field formations look like. And because even though it was only a month, it really changed a lot of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Colonel Theodore Roosevelt Jr. participated as a reserve officer.
And he was a Medal of Honor.
Right.
As his father.
John Coolidge, who was Calvin Coolidge's son, was participating in the year when he suddenly became President Coolidge's son.
Oh.
So it was something that was really an interesting portion of history because you don't hear about it that much.
No,
you know, that
never. Not until we researched this episode of the podcast did I even know what CMTC or CCC was.
Right.
I had never heard of it before.
Right. So, I mean.
Thank you, Susan.
This is my job, Sean. This is what I do. I give you little pieces of information that you didn't know before.
So I have two questions for
you. All right.
So the first one, when you had mentioned that they were selecting businessmen, is that because they were looking for educated men or was there another reason
behind
that?
So it was the businessmen who were selecting themselves.
Oh.
So this
was... So they didn't necessarily put out a call.
No, I think it was a naturally occurring movement that was happening like among the wealthy in New York. This idea among the
like a hunting club without guns,
right? Kind of
like
thing.
Like a social, yeah,
and they probably were looking for, I mean, and that's why it was originally aimed at young men in college. Mm-hmm. You know, for the summer. What do you do over the summer? Well, you can learn a little bit about the military. You can learn a little bit about something. You can see, you know, there was certainly an idea that they were looking for officer candidates. Mm-hmm. They were looking for the more educated population. Future leaders of America.
There you go. And my second question is, when did the artillery regiment realize that horses were no longer needed?
Well, it wasn't during the time of Fort Hoyle.
Okay.
Because there's one interview with a Colonel Hoyle, mm-hmm. Colonel DeRussy Hoyle, who was actually the son of Eli Hoyle, who ended up in command at Fort Hoyle. And
say that again.
The son of Eli Hoyle, for yes. whom Fort Hoyle was named,
correct.
Was Colonel DeRussy Hoyle,
mm-hmm.
and he ended up in command of Fort Hoyle at some point in the 1930s.
Wow. Okay.
And there's an interview with him, and he talks about the value of horses.
Mm-hmm.
And he said at the time he had led motorized artillery units as well as horse-drawn artillery units, and he saw the value of both of them.
The reason I was asking is because there is silent footage that exists from Fort Hoyle, and you can see that there's motorized vehicles pulling the cannons and so on like that, and not horses.
Right. So I think they were in a transitional phase. Mm-hmm. You know, they were using both during the 1930s. It just happens that, like, the 6th Field Artillery happened to be a horse-mounted unit.
Okay.
But there were certainly already motorized units.
Well, they left us a beautiful gymnasium.
That's right. You can go work out with where the horsies used to play.
Well, Susan, you know, I take pride in coming up with very unique, entertaining names, but I'm having a tough one with this. So we might just have to settle for Fort Hoyle.
You didn't like my horses and courses at Fort Hoyle suggestion?
Wait a minute. I think we got something.
All right.
That's pretty good. I like it. We're going to go with that. Fort Hoyle, horses and courses. Lovely. Anyway, this has been wonderful, as usual. And Susan, do we have a special surprise for our audience?
Oh, I'm a little scared.
Well, you should be. And that is, next week, we will be celebrating the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army.
That's right.
So we will have a special podcast, so you won't have to wait another 2 weeks to hear our next episode. Next week, we'll be talking about Aberdeen Proving Ground and its involvement in the wars to celebrate the Army's 250. How's that sound?
It sounds like I better start researching.
I'm saying you've got a lot of work ahead of you.
All right.
Just don't expect me to do all the heavy lifting again. But anyway.
I'll try to be one of the 6 horses this time. And not the cranky mule.
All right. And to make sure that you don't miss next week's episode, make sure you hit that follow button. You shouldn't be listening to anything else but this podcast.
That's right, Sean. We're the best.
That we are. And until then, thank you for joining us.